Welcome to Parents' Perspective. Ooh, squealed 10-year-old Tina. What's in the package? Just wait till your sisters are here, her mom cautioned. Then you'll see. Minutes later, Jen, age 12, and Diane, age 8, came dashing down the stairs and into the hall, where their mom and sister were standing by a box. Glad you're all here, their mom smiled. I wanted to bring you something special from my trip, so here it is, one for each of you. The girls tore into the brown paper wrapping and plunged into the layers of tissue paper, finally pulling out three identical pink sundresses covered with tiny red hearts. Diane held hers up, eyes shining. Just what I've always wanted, she squealed. I'm going to try it on. She gave her mother a hug. Thanks, Mom. Tina looked at her dress quizzically. Mom, she began, I never wear pink. It looks so yucky with my red hair. Why didn't you think to get me a blue one? Jen just tossed her dress back into the box. Mom, how could you? She wailed. This is a baby dress. No one my age wears sundresses with little teeny hearts. How old do you think I am? And she ran back up the stairs. Oh, Tina, her mom sank onto the bottom step. I just wanted to treat you all equally. There's always such bickering over things. It feels like nothing will work. From a parent's perspective, what can we do about sibling rivalry? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Today, we welcome back two longtime friends to Parents' Perspective who really know how to deal with sibling issues. Dr. T. Barry Brazelton was able to integrate his dual interests, primary care pediatrics and child psychiatry, in 1972 when he established the Child Development Unit, a pediatric training and research center at Children's Hospital Boston. He is as well a parent advocate. In recent years, his growing concern about the pressures and stresses that families face has led to appearances before congressional committees in support of parental and medical leave bills. Dr. Brazelton has worked to improve child care support for all working parents. In 1989, Congress appointed him to the National Commission on Children, where he advocated for disadvantaged children. To further his work, the Brazelton Touchpoints Center at Children's Hospital Boston was founded in 1993 to mobilize communities around children and families in order to bring relationships back into health care and to transform child care into family care. In 2002, Dr. Brazelton received the World of Children Award for his achievements in child advocacy. Dr. Brazelton is the father of four and grandfather of six. Welcome back, Dr. B.
Thank you. Fun to be back here.
Dr. Joshua D. Sparrow, child, adolescent, and general psychiatrist, is assistant professor of psychiatry at the Harvard Medical School, director of special initiatives at the Brazelton Touchpoint Center, supervisor for outpatient psychiatry services at Children's Hospital Boston, and has served as associate professor of psychiatry at the School of Medicine of the University of Marseille in Marseille, France. Co-author with Dr. T. Barry Brazelton of 8 books translated into at least 7 languages, Dr. Sparrow is also a regular contributor to Family Circle and Parent and Child magazines and author of numerous scholarly papers published in the United States and Europe. He has served as consultant to a number of media programs, both national and international. Dr. Sparrow has 2 grown children, a daughter and a son. We're so glad you could be with us again.
That's great to talk with both of you again.
We want to talk a little bit about sibling rivalry today, since you have a new book out, Understanding Sibling Rivalry, The Brazelton Way. What would you say is a parent's biggest challenge connected with sibling rivalry?
If they can't stay out of it.
Somehow I knew you were going to say that.
Well, it's so hard. And yet, you know, siblings learning so much about each other. Rivalry is one side of the coin. Caring about each other is the other side. And so as soon as a parent can trust the older child with the younger one, it ought to be left to them. They learn so much from each episode of sibling rivalry if they can learn it from each other.
Is it safe to leave them alone
it's
together?
Got to be. It's got to be.
How old can they be when it's finally safe?
You know, I was in practice about 50 years in Cambridge, and I only had one episode of a child really hurting another because I don't think they really hurt each other unless there's an adult nearby.
I used to hide in the bathroom. That's why I'm asking now if it's
safe. Oh, good.
When you raise a bunch of boys.
From your siblings or from your children?
I hid from my children when they were fighting with each other. There were three little boys.
Yep. And I bet they learned a heck of a lot about each other and care about each other.
I think as soon as the youngest is old enough to get out of the way or call for help, then you're probably okay. I think that one exception to this is when there's something going on in either of the child's world that might push them to be more aggressive than the usual range. And that happens, for example, when there's a lot of fighting among parents or there's been a loss or other major pressures or stresses, then the kind of aggression you might see may go beyond the kind that the younger sibling could protect her or himself from.
That's a good point. I hadn't thought of that. But in general, our thinking is that children learn so much about each other if it's left to them. And I would recommend to most parents with most of these episodes that you say, look, this is your issue, not mine. Do you know why parents get so involved?
You also feel so responsible. You feel so guilty for having burdened that older child with the second one.
And you feel like you don't have enough to go around, so you got to make up for it whenever they make a plea like being in a struggle with each other. Oh, I've got to go settle this and let the older one know he's responsible. The younger one know you can't tease the older one like that. So you just almost can't stay out of it.
Well, it's your little world that you feel like you need to control.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you say to them, I know you two can figure this out on your own, you're saying to them, I'm giving you responsibility, but also the respect that goes with that. And I'm honoring you with my belief that you can live up to that. It doesn't always work, but
it's worth a try.
That's a good line.
You know, it may not work at the time, but the way you'd like it. I bet those three did beat each other up. But, you know, look what they learned. And look how much they respect each other now. Our four, we were able to step out of it because I felt so strongly. I hated my younger brother till he was 50 because my mother couldn't stay out of it. She had to tell me, leave him alone. And him, you know, you must respect your older brother. All these things that didn't make any sense at all to us.
Oh, dear.
And then his brother died.
No,
oh dear, no,
we got
they had five good years together.
Well, he
you
died
did get
after
to be
that,
friends first.
And I felt very guilty about his death, but I hadn't wished that hard.
No. We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on understanding sibling rivalry.
Washington, D.C. with Kids, an excellent book by authors Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Dr. T. Barry Brazelton and Dr. Joshua D. Sparrow about understanding sibling rivalry. What would you say is the myth that we all have then about sibling rivalry?
You want them to love each other.
If we can only fix it, then they'll love each other.
And be so glad they've got each other.
And that angry feelings aren't a part of the intense love that is also a part of sibling relationships.
One of the things that really surprised me was being the mother of only boys, that evidently the way boys sort of react to each other, sort of like saying hi as they bop each other.
That's right.
As a girl,
well, you should
have
seen Dr. Brazelton and I beating each other up on the elevator.
Stay away from each other.
Girls don't do that.
No. I could never understand it. I thought, if they want to say hi, why don't they just say hi?
There's a lot of punching.
You know, have you ever watched two little boys come together? They could come together and lock and get down on the floor struggling around. And I think this is bound to happen with siblings.
Right. I think that there's another myth about sibling rivalry, perhaps in some cultures more than others. But I think that these days there's so much pressure on parents to be perfect parents. Mm. And it comes partly from having children later sometimes. It comes partly from both parents having to work. And it also comes from the whole child expert industry that we're a part of, unfortunately, which makes parents feel as if everything has to be happy and good and the children have to love each other, as if that didn't include also getting angry with each other. And it's harder, I think, for parents to see that there is so much to be gained not from parenting each child as an individual, but from parenting the children as a family, which sometimes means that one child is unhappy because she's gotten punished for something the other child did too, because there's discipline for the whole family. But what happens as a result is that the children have a sense of being a part of a group.
Against the parents, basically.
That's right, yeah. And stronger bonds with each other forevermore.
I think there's another mechanism at work today, because I do think it's more precious or at risk or whatever you want to call it, and that is that we can't have big families anymore. Big families were such a cushion for all of this because they had to get along. They had to take care of each other. Mm-hmm. And I think all of us now who have, I've had to do this, but I watch my children do it, give up with one or two children, go through a kind of mourning. You know, they really would like to have four children. They all say it to us, but we can't afford them. We can't do it. We all have to work, which they do. And I think it's giving up on something. I've worked with the one-child family in China, and I could see the mourning that women really had to go through in giving up to just one child. And I think our small families make it a lot tougher to stay out of it and to leave it to the kids.
Do you think also the fact that we have nuclear families that are usually separated geographically from the support system that we used to have, mm-hmm, in the old days,
sure,
of extended family,
yeah,
then there's no institutional memory, it seems.
Right. Even grandmothers, you know, come in and say, oh, you should get along with each other, forgetting what it was like with those three kids.
But you would think you could have great Aunt Helen who would say, oh, yeah, yeah, you know, you and your brother used to fight all the time. It's not a big deal.
That's like a cushion for all kinds of parenting today. I think it's one of the biggest pressures on people that they lead such lonely parenting lives, that without the supports that, you know, we could provide in this country if we put our mind to it.
See, we push all the time for parents to link up with each other and to connect with other
parents. That's wonderful.
Because we really feel, both of us having raised, mm-hmm, children, having gone through this, the support you find from other people in your stage of life, mm-hmm, even if they're younger or older, but they're still in the child-rearing stage of, say, toddlers, you share your miseries and you share your pleasures and you share a new book you've discovered or a new expert that you'd like to know more about. I think it makes an enormous difference to have a peer group, support group.
I tell pediatricians that they should get parents in with the children the same age, and while the parents are waiting 3 to 4 hours for the pediatrician, they can learn a lot more from each other than they'll ever learn from him or her, so they might as well get going.
Are there some life stages where siblings are more likely to have serious conflicts with each other than at other times?
I hadn't thought about it that way. That's an interesting question.
Well, as in touch points?
You know what a touch point is? It's a time when the child is regressing and is acting out in different ways, and nobody quite understands these ways, and probably disrupts the whole family as a system. And it's just before they take a spurt in development. And I would think that would be a time when the other children would get anxious and settle in on that one child.
And then if you have enough children, you could have something like that going on all the time.
That's right.
Yeah, absolutely. People would learn how to get along with each other.
There are some books that you've written on touch points, which are still out there and available, and wonderful references. I just want to put in a little plug because I think they're essential to anybody raising young children.
You know, we have an outreach program called Touch Points now that Josh and I are working on. And it's a wonderful way of reaching out for parents, because that's the time they need you.
What about the business of older siblings and younger siblings? We hear all about preparing the older sibling for the birth of the younger sibling. We talk about birth order and the issues that go with that. What's your take on all this?
Oh, tell the story about Leslie, Dr. B.
Well, parents always say, when should I tell my child I'm pregnant? And I go back to this little boy, 4-year-old, and he kept going, every time he'd go down to the floor, he'd go, and I thought, gee, what in the world? And I felt his belly and his hips and everything, and I couldn't find anything wrong. Finally, it just dawned on me, and I said to the mother, are you pregnant? And she said, oh, no, not on your life. And she called me a week later, and she said, how did you know I was pregnant? And I said, well, I didn't, but Leslie did.
Oh, wow.
Oh, isn't that cute?
Before she even knew it herself.
We each have stories about older kids who, you know, look at the younger kids and say, you know, why did you need him or that kind of thing.
That's right. Why do you think they say it? To make their mommies and their daddies feel guilty.
You don't think that they feel that they might be displaced? We always, you know, heard the story of the husband bringing home another wife. Hey, honey, I liked you so much. I thought we could have another
wife.
Well, of course they do. But I think that's why you have to assume that they understand far more than most parents like to believe they do, sooner than they do. And then you can give them permission to ask exactly that kind of question even before the baby arrives.
You know what I'd say when that comes up, because it does make the parent feel guilty. I think the child may be expressing more of a challenge than the sadness that he seems to be expressing. But at that point, I would urge every parent to do something that I feel very strongly about. Have an hour, and that's all it takes, at the end of every week when you go off with each child individually and you get to know that child, they get to know you, then you can talk about it all week long. You know, I don't have time right now because whatever, but I will have your time with you this weekend. And aren't we going to have a good time? And then the child feels like, I've still got a part of my mommy or my daddy. And both parents ought to do this.
I think there's another thing to add to how to handle those kinds of questions which make parents feel so guilty. When the guilt comes in a parent with a child's question, the tendency is to try to negate and reassure right away and say, oh, of course not. But that doesn't really honor the importance to the child of the question. And I think you have to first listen and ask them more, well, what makes you think that? So that by the time you get around to whatever your way is of reassuring them, they really know that you've taken them seriously and really understood what they've been worried about.
Call it active listening.
You know, it's so hard to be a listener as a parent. We're trained to be a teller. Mm-hmm. Do it.
Right.
Instead
we're
of
using
listening.
Our words.
Josh but keeps saying, you know, ask them, well, what are you worried about? Tell me what you're worried about, and then I'll have a better chance to help you.
And it's very hard to do as a parent when a big part of our wish for our child is to protect them from unhappiness. And when we feel as if we've imposed something on them that will make them unhappy, of course it's harder for us to listen, and we feel more urgently about reassuring them. But I think it's somewhat easier to begin to give children permission to ask those questions and to really find out what's going on in their thoughts when we recognize that our job isn't really about making our children happy, but about being strong and resilient enough to be able to deal with whatever comes their way. And happiness is only a part of that.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on understanding sibling rivalry.
For an audio CD of any parent's perspective show, send a check or money order for $10 with your name, address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C. 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Dr. T. Barry Brazelton and Dr. Joshua D. Sparrow about understanding sibling rivalry.
I think our kids are going through a lot these days. This war and 9/11 has really cost them a great, great deal. And their future, look, we're leaving them in the way of a world. And I was on the National Commission, you all mentioned that, and we went around the country for 2 years, about 20 of us, and we came away with the realization that we're the least child and family-oriented society in the world.
I'm not
what
surprised.
What is that all?
I'm
and it's getting
so
worse.
So
it's not
sad.
Better. Mm-hmm. You know, we all know children are our future. You know, that's not an issue. But do we act as if they are? No. We're a country that believes in war and money and power and aggression. This is a tragic sort of thing to hand on to our children. So I would want to change our national values. It's a very stressful time for young parents. I really admire what they're having to do today that is significantly more stressful than when I was raising my kids.
And that was actually the main reason why we wrote both this book on sibling rivalry and the one on mastering anger and aggression. We think that early in life, parents have a real opportunity to help their children learn how to get along by helping them learn to care about other people, and that without that, we're all really in deep trouble.
Our Touchpoints project demands that you turn all negatives into positives. It is so powerful. The second you begin to admire a parent for what they are doing rather than what they're not doing, it's just like a miracle. And the same thing with children. When you say to them, oh, look what you just did for your brother, aren't you great? They look at you like, oh, my gosh, yeah, I did do pretty well, didn't I? And they sit up straight. They
positive
have a different self-image. Yeah.
In some families, there's one child that may have special needs or a developmental delay of some sort. How can you help us deal with those kinds of issues with the rest of the family?
Well, I see the family as a system, and every member of the system is sort of in balance with every other member. And so one is out of whack. All the others are expected to be out of whack. And so you have to account for that and say, okay, how do we get back to the balance that we need in this family? And it's very demanding. I think it takes a lot of understanding on the parents' part, and they need help from outside. That's why we set off all of these intervention programs and these support programs for special needs children, because the families need them as much as the child does.
On the one hand, the sibling of a child with a chronic illness or a special need may feel enormous pressure to make up for whatever the other child doesn't have, to be the perfect child and to perform in ways the other child can, or to be a caretaker well beyond his or her years. And, of course, parents have to be sensitive to those kinds of pressures, and it's very hard when the whole family is so stressed by the needs of this child who is ill or has a special need. But at the same time, I think parents can also look at some of the positive aspects for the healthy sibling of having this special role if they respect when there are signs that there's too much pressure. It's also possible to see that the child begins to really be proud of the part of his or her identity that is being a very good caretaker. And although you can't go backwards and erase that part of their experience, you can give them the opportunity to turn that into something important in their identity that they end up doing wonderful things with later. So as Dr. Braslin says, it really is a balance between protecting from the pressure, but also recognizing that you can't entirely and that good things can come of it.
Well, you know, I did a study in Cambridge when everybody began to go down the drain with drugs in the late 60s, and it was terrifying. We were all so scared when pot first hit Cambridge. So I got all of the parents together, and I looked at all the variables that I knew because I'd taken care of all these families, you know, intermittently for a long time. And I got all the variables together to see which kids disappeared to Haight-Ashbury and all that. And I couldn't predict the ones that would go, but I could predict the ones that wouldn't go. Guess what? They were all kids who had a stress in the family, like a special needs child, and had learned to deal with it. And those kids were invulnerable to peer pressure. Isn't that reassuring?
It's really That's impressive.
Really interesting. Mm-hmm.
So it's not the worst thing that can happen to a family to have something that you all learn to cope with together. And it really is a matter of looking for resilience and coping systems that you can pass on to the children, model for the children. And I guess one thing I've seen, and I think we really value, is that many of these kids go into a helping profession when they grow up. Isn't that interesting? Mm-hmm. Isn't that fascinating?
It's amazing where your life's work comes from.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is, as usual, a very frustrating conversation to close, but we must do this at this point. So before we do, can you give us any other resources that you would suggest in addition to your book, Understanding Sibling Rivalry, The Braselton Way?
www.touchpoints.org.
We want to thank Dr. T. Barry Braselton and Dr. Joshua Sparrow for being with us. It's always wonderful to have you guys here, and we always learn so much. So thanks a lot.
It's great to talk
with
you again.
Thank you.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of Understanding Sibling Rivalry, The Braselton Way by Dr. T. Barry Braselton and Dr. Joshua D. Sparrow. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8255. 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573. And please spell anything that's not obvious. That would help us a lot. Mention show number 263 and tell us what station you're listening to. Since we're airing all over the world, it's always fun to know what station you're tuning into.
To learn more about Parents' Perspective and our latest book, Washington, D.C. with Kids, visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org. That's www.parentsperspective.org. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. We'd like to remind you about some important toll-free numbers for parents and kids. National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, 1-800-THE-LOST, 1-800-843-5678, and National Runaway Switchboard, 1-800-621-4000. Our sound engineer is Damon Fisher. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.